Welcome to Notes from America. My name is Petrina Engelke, and frankly, I had no idea through how many hoops Americans have to jump in order to vote. Hence this interview, because luckily, Kat Calvin set me straight. She's a lawyer and a voting rights expert and the founder of Spread the Vote. Her organization is dedicated to removing a very particular voting obstacle that is affecting about 21 million Americans. Kat will join me in a few minutes, and then at first we will compare notes. What do you need to do in order to exercise your right to vote? Germany versus US style. Also coming up, some context of when and how voter ID laws and other rules started, which really helps connecting the dots to why is this happening? And then Kat had to run, but of course I won't leave you hanging dry, falling really hard into some kind of voter suppression depression. No! I'll summarize a few easy things that you can do, especially what you can do to make sure you are all set for November 3rd, which, of course, is Election Day. You'll find a few links in the show notes, too. And if you also find this podcast interesting, please subscribe to Notes from America so you won't miss a new episode. And also tell your friends about it. Now, here's the interview with Kat Calvin. We recorded it in July. Joining me now is Kat Calvin. She's a lawyer, a voting rights expert, and the founder of Spread the Vote. She also just recently started Vote the Podcast with Andrea Haley from Vote.org. But now, here's Kat Calvin. Welcome to Notizen aus Amerika, Kat.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with Spread the Vote in a nutshell. What does Spread the Vote do?
Sure. So here in the States, rather recently, really since about 2011-ish, we have had these things called voter ID laws. So in the States, unlike in most countries, you don't just automatically get a state ID card. It's something you have to initiate yourself and pay for yourself, et cetera. So we have over 21 million adults in this country who don't have ID. And so these laws have started passing that require ID cards or some form of identification. It varies by state in order to be able to vote. We also need ID for getting jobs or housing, et cetera. So the population of folks who don't have ID tend to be much lower income or have no income, tend to be experiencing homelessness, things like that. And so the process of getting ID requires a lot of documents. It can be rather expensive. It can, you know, our average cost is $40, which is quite a lot when you don't have a job. Or for a lot of us who do have jobs, I have to still think twice about spending $40. And so what we do in 12 states, these laws are in 36 states now, although in every state, for some reason, you need an ID to vote. But we work in 12 states where we help people get all of the documents required. We pay for all of them. We help them do all of the things it takes to get an ID. And then while they use those IDs for jobs and housing and medical care and all the things you need them for here, what we also do is we help all of those clients who are eligible to vote actually vote. So we do a lot of voter education and we help folks get to the polls and make sure that they feel empowered about being able to cast their vote.
Wow, that's quite a lot. And I have a lot of questions about that.
Yes.
But first of all, I'm going to try to explain to you where I'm coming from as a German immigrant and why voting at first, I mean, I'm not a citizen, so I'm not allowed to vote, but I know people who can. And it still was a little confusing to me. So in Germany, we have things that I think there aren't even English words for. So we have something I would call a register of residence of some sort. So within 2 months of moving to a new address, you have to register this address at an office in town. And that's why the local board of elections always has an up-to-date voter roll because they have all the addresses. And ahead of an election, the board of elections sends everyone a postcard that's like a voting card. It has the information of the polling place where you're going to, and you just have to present this card in order to vote. If you somehow misplaced the card, you can use your ID. And the ID in Germany is mandatory. So everybody over 16 has to have a state-issued ID. It's the law. So it's a little different. And also, this card that you are, postcard you're being sent, that also has information if you want to vote at a different polling station. Maybe you need an accessible station. Or if you want to vote by mail, you just, cross the little sign and say, I want to vote by mail, and put it in a mailbox, and the government pays for the postage, and then you get your mail-in ballot, or you can, go to a different polling station. So that said, can you walk me through what a person in the U.S. has to do if they want some type of ID when there is no government, overall issued ID, that's a federal ID that you can use everywhere?
It's a little different. I mean, so it's funny. I went to kindergarten, first and second grade in Germany. And loved it. We loved Germany. We were very sad when we had to leave. I miss it a lot. And I am... we're always comparing ourselves to other countries. And I think one of the things that it's really important and confusing to understand is that one of the challenges with the way that we run elections is in this country is that there are all actually very, very few federal standards. Every single state gets to make its own decisions about most aspects of elections. So there are some things that are constitutional, like, election day is always the first Tuesday in November, because that is what George Washington and the founding fathers decided many, many years ago. There's some things that are the same, but a lot of things are decided by 50 different governments. And then in each state, there are a lot of different things we call sort of similarly boards of elections who get to make decisions within those states on their own as well. So there are a lot of different rules. We don't have, neither the country nor any state has a sort of mandatory ID that everyone should have. We should. I think we're one of like few countries on the planet that doesn't. It is one of my life goals to make that happen. We'll see. But there also are different rules. So in every single state except North Dakota, you have to register to vote. So unlike Germany, where you're sort of automatically registered when you move to a place and you sort of report in where you live, you have to actually choose to fill out and it's not an application, because as long as you're eligible to vote, you can, but you have to actually choose to actively register to vote. So that's a piece of the process that everybody has to do. And then on top of that, voting and where you vote and the way you vote can be a little complicated. For IDs, it's sort of similar. It is a thing you have to choose to get, and that you, in most states, the DMV or the Department of Motor Vehicles, some states call them something different, but basically it's the DMV. And that is where you get both your driver's license, but also if you want a non-driver's ID or sort of a variety of types of IDs. And mostly you go to the DMV. And then at that, and this is somewhat standardized across the country, you have to take in a set of documents. So you always have to take in either a birth certificate, or you have to show sort of your proof of birth. So it can be some different things. Sometimes it can be a naturalization certificate or something like that. Most of the time it's a birth certificate. And then you also have to bring in proof of Social Security. So either your Social Security card, which is what we get from the Social Security Administration that has our Social Security number on it. You also, though, everybody loses their Social Security card. So you also, if you have a tax document, may have your Social Security number on it, but it has to be some sort of government-issued document that has that number on it. And then you have to show proofs of residency. So it varies by state, but you usually have to bring in, a voter registration card. So when you register, you get a physical card that will have your address on it, or, a utility bill or something like that, a lease, something to prove your residency. And you usually have to bring in a couple of those. And then also, you know, they may require additional proofs of identity. If this sounds like it's overbearing, overwhelming, and unnecessary, it's because it is. So you're not crazy. And so you may have to bring in some other records proving who you are. Or, you know, for instance, you have to bring in proof of every single time you've changed your name and why. So we have had to help, you know, elderly ladies who may have been married, divorced, married, widowed, whatever, a couple of times. And you have to bring in the original marriage certificate and death certificate and divorce decree, et cetera. So it's this huge stack of documents to prove that you are who you say you are and that you were actually born and that you live in a place and all of these things. Some of which are free to obtain, many of which are not, particularly birth certificates. And so you take all of these documents to the Department of Motor Vehicles and pay a fee which ranges for a variety of reasons from about $5, and in some states, if you are indigent, then it may be zero, to, you know, I think that the higher range is in the 30-ish, you know, $30, $34. You go through all of that and you pay, and then you get an ID. So it's quite a process. Well, and now we have this whole new Real ID thing, which is a whole federal standard. It requires more documents. It's very confusing. Thanks to COVID, the deadline's been pushed back another year. But it's, you know, it's a lot of documents. And for the folks we work with who are largely experiencing homelessness, or they may be very young, they're usually unemployed. We work with, you know, folks in a lot of our states. If you're an undocumented, you can still get an ID, but the document requirements are, of course, very different. You know, but there, it's a thing that can be very burdensome for a lot of people.
Yeah, I reckon. So you started that in 2017, right? So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good 3 years now. So what would you say, what have you achieved so far?
Well, you know, so we're the only national organization that helps folks get IDs. And so when I started Spread the Vote, there were a few things that we did. We built, you know, sort of all new technology to be able to help manage this process. It's a very grassroots, on the ground, you know, a volunteer working hand in hand with a client through the whole process. And as we're discovering during COVID, there are some ways that we can make it virtual, but at the end of the day, it's a person-to-person process. So we built out a lot of technology to help facilitate that. At this point, we have helped almost 5,000 people get their IDs, which is something we're very proud of. We register about 91% of our eligible voters to vote. About 20% of our clients are not eligible because we work with a lot of prisons and jails and places where people aren't eligible to vote yet, but still need ID in order to be able to get jobs and housing and things like that when they're released. And so we register about 91% of our eligible clients, and 77% of those have never voted before. And so then we work really hard on the other end to help them be able to vote and get that 0% turnout rate, because 100% of them can't vote without us because they're all in voter ID states. And we've gotten up to a little over 40%, which is something that we're very proud of, and trying to figure out how to recreate in an era when we can't just put people in our cars and take them to the polls. But we are.
Yes, that's, I wanted to ask about that. Yeah. So you used to help with travel. So that's really not possible during a pandemic, is it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what we're trying to do, so we've been getting IDs. We've gotten IDs every single week since COVID happened, although I grounded our staff, and we have, at this point, I think we're at over 1,000 trained volunteers at the very, very beginning of the pandemic. But we've been able to do some virtual work and then have been able to help arrange different types of safe transportation for our clients. At, of course, a much smaller scale than we're used to, but still sort of pushing forward. What we're looking at right now is figuring out both how do we do virtual voter education, because one thing that's important, you know, we're working with the absolute most vulnerable people in the country. So only 1% of our clients actually have regular access to a phone, and far fewer than that have access to email or the internet. And so all of the virtual solutions that work for almost everyone else in the country do not work for the 11% of the population that we work with. And so we are trying to work out ways of, you know, we always make our own voter guides and print them out. We will still be doing that and working very closely with our partners on the ground to help distribute those. We do work with jails and homeless shelters and social workers and caseworkers and people who even during COVID are still serving their community. And so we are working much closer with them to help be sure that we can do voter education still, and then figuring out, well, what are the safest ways for us to get people to the polls? Whether it be making sure everyone has PPE and, you know, putting them in Ubers, or if there are churches and organizations that are doing safe rides or whatever. And so that's all things that we are working on right now so that we can still try as hard as we can to get our clients to the polls.
Yeah. So basically, most of the states you're working in do not have absentee ballot option.
Well, they do. But, you know, the problem with getting a ballot mailed to your house is that if you don't have a home, you don't have a place to have it mailed to.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. It's really complicated trying to do things like get a ballot mailed to a shelter, et cetera. And it's also, you know, part of the reason that we do so much work in helping folks understand what's on the ballot is because our clients have never voted before. And so just looking at a ballot, whether it's absentee or you're in the polling place, is still really complicated. And so we still really want to do the hands-on work that we always do, just helping them understand this is what's on the ballot and this is what this office is and who's running for it and what they've said they believe in, et cetera, to help make sure that people really do feel like they know what they're doing. You know, but we also, it's so weird saying this to people who may not live in this country and will all think we're insane. I don't know, maybe we are. We're having a lot of challenges right now because the Supreme Court over the last few weeks has affirmed some really, I think, dangerous and suppressive policies that some states have had around absentee voting, which are making it much, much more difficult for people to vote absentee, and particularly for folks who don't have ID. And so we are also dealing with the challenge of the fact that absentee voting is, in some of our states, getting much easier. I live in California. Our governor, very early in the COVID process, just said, hey, I'm just going to send a ballot home to everybody. Like, this is ridiculous. And that's great. But there are some states where the process has been made much more difficult, which sort of goes back to what I was saying. Every single state gets to make its own rules. And so, yeah, that the absentee piece is also something we're really trying to figure out. How can we, in the states where it has become or is becoming more challenging and there are new rules being passed every day, we have a long way to go till November. How do we make sure that our clients and folks who are not our clients who may be trying to vote absentee for the first time can overcome the barriers that are being placed in front of them?
Wow, you're doing so many things, education and transport. And so I'm guessing that also costs a lot of money if you're covering the costs and you need some staff. So can you talk a little bit about your funding? Who gives money to a cause like that? And what does that mean for you as the leader of Spread the Vote?
Sure. Well, for anyone who knows anyone who runs a nonprofit or is a politician, we're exactly the same. All we ever do is ask for money. And it's, you know, for us particularly, you know, the difference in cost when everything you do can be virtual versus when everything we do has to be, you know, printed out and in person because we are working with a non-virtual community really makes a difference. And then, yeah, we are, you know, this year I was like, look, we're in the apocalypse. Our country is falling apart. So we really need to expand. Also, we can't go anywhere. I haven't left this room in months. So I have more time because I have no social life anymore. So we really need to expand the work that we're doing. There are so many ways that voting this year will be so different and so much more challenging than ever before because of COVID, particularly, and then sort of other issues on top of it, that, yeah, we are taking on a little more than usual. So our funding comes from a few places. If any of your listeners would like to donate, and as a nonprofit, we can take international donations. You can go to spreadthevote.org/donate. And that online, you know, sort of grassroots, just individuals donating small sums makes up a good portion of our funding and is really incredible. And there are a lot of amazing people who, you know, will give us $5, $10, $20 or a little more, and they're amazing. There are also a lot of family foundations in the States, and I don't know if this is a similar thing elsewhere, probably because there are rich people everywhere. There are a lot of, Bill Gates has a family foundation. That's not a small foundation, you know, and then donate it. And it's really amazing. It wasn't something I was super familiar with before I started working in the nonprofit world, but it really is a lot of people who are like, hey, we're really lucky. And also, yes, it's a tax break, but they could give to it. They could do a lot of things and, you know, really choose to give to organizations that are working on causes they care about, whether it be education or the climate or whatever. We have a lot of donors who may really care about one issue, but they understand that if you care about any issue, then you have to care about voting. And so they're, you know, they're really wonderful foundations that give to us, you know, some sort of a larger donors. And then there are a lot of, you know, people who will, you know, put on events for us or things like that. Right now, it's all virtual events, which I love because I don't have to get in my car. I don't have to put on clothes. It's great. I'm really loving the virtual event lifestyle.
Wait, you're doing virtual events with no clothes?
Just pajamas. Pajamas. All right. All right. Not an X-rated podcast. I wear the same PJs every day, saving a lot on laundry costs. Yeah. And so it's sort of, it varies between individual donors, some foundations and just, you know, larger donors who sort of all give in varying amounts.
I see. Yeah. That's quite the mix. I want to go back to you touched on the Supreme Court decision earlier, and I mentioned that you also know things about the law. There are two law decisions that I'm curious about. That is one from 2013, a Supreme Court decision called
Shelby County versus B. Holder.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And the Voting Rights, and it's related to the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And I was wondering, can you try to briefly explain what that decision is, what it dismantled, and what, you know, what the outcome is nowadays?
Sure. Well, briefly is tough, but here I go. One thing I think that's important context to understand voting in America is that every single group of people other than white male landed gentry in this country have had to fight very hard for the right to vote. Women, Black people, like everybody. And so in 1965, I'm sure everyone knows the Civil Rights Act and Martin Luther King and et cetera, there was a very big fight because although technically Blacks had won the right to vote and there was a constitutional amendment, we weren't actually allowed to vote in most states, and particularly a large subset of Southern states. But don't let anybody from a Northern state like lie to you and say that they were just letting people vote because they weren't. It was very, very difficult. There were laws put into place in each state we call Jim Crow laws that were, you know, there were a lot of racist laws, like, you know, you can't sit at the front of a bus or use certain water fountains, et cetera. But also that made voting very difficult, if not impossible. There were tests put into place. You know, my grandmother watched her parents save money in a jar every year so that they could pay the poll tax because they made you pay in order to vote. They did all sorts of things. They had a grandfather clauses in some states, so you could only vote if your grandfather could vote. Well, your grandfather couldn't vote if he was Black because it was illegal then. So they did all sorts of things to make sure that we couldn't vote. And so a huge part of the Civil Rights Act was fighting for the right to vote, which we won when the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965, which put a lot of federal laws into place and then was backed up by the military, which it took to desegregate this country. Basically saying, no, everybody has a right to vote and you're going to get rid of these Jim Crow laws. And if you want to, and this is the key piece, if you are one of these particular states that has been particularly egregious in these areas, if you want to change anything about your voting laws, it has to be approved by the Department of Justice of the United States. So you have to go to the DOJ and say, we want to change this rule. And then they will review it. And they'll either say, yep, this sounds great, or this is extremely racist, go away. And so that was the law from 1965 to 2013. in which we saw massive advances in the number of Black Americans who were voting across the country and the number of diverse candidates, et cetera. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, decided that since things were going so well, racism must be over, so we don't need the Voting Rights Act anymore. And they took away that piece that said that if any states want to change their voting rules, they have to get it approved by the DOJ. As soon as they did that, and I mean literally within 2 hours, Texas and Alabama and then other states started drastically changing their voting laws to make them more suppressive, to reduce the number of people who could vote. And so that's when we saw a big expansion in voter ID laws. We have seen things called voter purging happening. Like, all of these things have started because we no longer have the protections of the Voting Rights Act to stop states from suppressing the vote. And so that is a big part of why you're seeing as many challenges with voting as we have now.
So the ongoing argument that we also hear these days, that these were different times, that somehow didn't hold. So in general, what do you see as typical means of voter suppression? Because I think that's the right term to call it, right? It's
It's absolutely voter suppression. So typical means of voter suppression in this country are wide ranging. So, you know, we've talked about voter ID laws. That's certainly one. There is this new thing, relatively new, that people are doing called voter purging, which is when states will look at the list of people who are registered to vote and say, you know, oh, well, this person hasn't voted in the last two elections. We're just going to unregister them. And the way that they do that can be more or less dodgy. And so people will try to go to vote and they'll realize that they've been unregistered and they didn't know. We see a lot of polling places being manipulated so that in wealthy white areas, there will be multiple polling places and they'll be in very bright, clean, sunny spaces. And so the lines will be very, very short. And then if you go to poor areas or areas where people of color live, there will be far fewer polling places and they will be more difficult to get to. And there will be lines that are hours and hours long, or there, and they will have, you know, either older voting machines or far fewer voting machines, things like that. There are a lot of problems with, you know, we have the American Disabilities Act. We have laws about how people with disabilities are supposed to have accommodations in polling places. And yet, over and over and over, we see people who have disabilities who should be allowed to vote being turned away or not having the accommodations they're supposed to have, et cetera. You know, there's also a lot of discrimination against people who maybe don't speak English as a first language, even though there are rules about when we do have to have ballots that are in different languages, et cetera. I could go on and on. We're very good in this country at coming up with ways big and small to prevent people from voting. If you're a college student, the attempts that are made every year to make sure that college students can't vote sometimes get so drastic that they're ridiculous. But, you know, there are just a lot of work done because the people who are in power want to stay in power. And when you have new people voting, they probably want new ideas, which means new people. So in order to stay in power, it's very important to make sure that new people can't vote. And that's really what voter suppression is about keeping away people who are going to want change. And we have a lot of ways of doing it here.
All right. Wow. Yeah, that was a very good explanation of that. I was about to ask why, and you already did it. Awesome. Kat, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. And thank you to your listeners. I know, and I've been very lucky to live in a lot of places and travel a lot of places. And I know how much in this globalized world, what we all do affects each other. And, you know, we spend so much time looking to Germany, which has, you know, such great leadership in so many different ways, particularly right now with COVID and et cetera. But, you know, I think it is really important that we all pay more attention to how each other's elections work, and not just people paying attention to us, but us paying attention to other countries, because we are all just so deeply affected. And I think that is something we're clearly seeing right now. So I really appreciate you doing this and everyone who's listening, because I think the more we know about how we work, the more we can work together.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bettina. This was great.
That was Kat Calvin, founder of Spread the Vote and also co-host of Vote the Podcast, which she hosts with Andrea Haley of Vote.org. I hope that is not confusing. So Vote the Podcast, you'll find it in your podcatchers. And Vote.org, that's a website recommended widely as a great resource for all kinds of questions related to voting in the upcoming election. Now, Kat and I just discussed how hard it can be to vote in this country, but the good thing is you can do something about it for yourself and, if you like, also for others. Two things are really crucial here: knowledge and planning. Both of these are free and pretty easy. Find out what you need to do, when and where, in order to vote, and then plan what exactly you are going to do. After that, of course, you can decide to sit back on your holy grail like Lord Know-It-All, but you can also share your knowledge. So how do you start? Well, pick a reliable source to find all the info that you need. Every state in the US has an official election website that publishes all information regarding the voting process and regarding all the deadlines. Then there are sites like vote.org that also help you find out, and they also have links to the official sites so you can cross-check and make sure it's a reliable site that you're looking at. So now you got the website, you know where you live, so you know where to look. And now you do your research. Are you registered to vote? And if not, how can you do that right in this moment? After that, find out, can you vote by mail where you live? And if you want to do that, where do you request a mail-in ballot? And what are the rules to make sure that your mail-in ballot is counted? For instance, there are sometimes some very particular rules what to do with your ballot and where to sign it and in which kind of envelope to put it. It's a little origami, but you'll get it. Other questions are, can you vote early? When? Where is your polling station? When is it open? What do you need to bring? Write it all down, maybe, and then make a few decisions to pin down how and when you will vote. Make a plan. Put everything in your calendar. Set up reminders. Oh, and anything you can do right now, do it now. Even if it means you don't hear the end of this podcast when I again ask you to tell your friends about it and, ooh, yeah, I already did. Talking about your friends, you just wrote down all that info and now you also are kind of an expert on this voting thing in your place, right? So why not help your friends make their own plans? Help your grandma or the folks in this weekend's Netflix party or your origami group, you know, with the ballot thing that comes in handy. And isn't it a great way to bug your sister who's always late? If you make a solid plan to vote and you know everything you need to make it go smoothly, that is one vote that overcomes whatever obstacles are out there. And if you help 15 other people get the necessary info and 10 of them actually go through with it, that's 11 votes, those 10 and yours. And if these 10 people also help 15 people, you don't really have to be good at math to realize you just started a movement from your couch. Extra points for the fastest! If your state allows it and you can vote early or vote by mail and you decide to do that, that means not only can you feel really good about being way ahead of the crowd, but also in your polling station on November 3rd, the lines will be a little less long. So that is something you can do. If you actually want to go out and do something, consider working at a polling station. Yeah, that's a really long day, but it's paid work, and many elderly people who usually staff those polling stations, they won't do it this year because of COVID-19. no staff, no polling station. So the U.S. really, really needs as many people as possible who can and will make sure that there are many polling stations. Now, if you'd rather hear a little bit more of my accent and you want to know more about things like voting by mail or gerrymandering or how safe voting really is, listen to part one of this mini-series in which I talk to Elaine K. Mark of the Brookings Institution. And if you still want more, you have to wait a little bit because I'm still working on the next installment, which will be a two-part series about the great American outdoors. Yeah, then we can relax. And again, subscribe to Notes from America, tell your friends, and stay tuned.